For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Why don't you turn with me tonight to Matthew chapter 22, and we'll do a little bit of study on what could fairly be called the big picture. We read in verse 35 of Matthew 22, one of the people there, a lawyer, a specialist in, and when they say lawyer, that would be not like our lawyers, but a master student of the Old Testament scriptures that they called the law. So a lawyer was a student and a scribe of the Old Testament scriptures. And one of them, a theologian, came forward asking him a question to test him. He says, "Teacher, what is the greatest commandment in the law?" And Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the first and the greatest commandment. And then a second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself." And he says, "All the law and the prophets hang on these two commandments." So that's a really, that's a very strong language when you think about it. No wonder we say this is the big picture. If he's willing to reduce a legal code that involves several hundred commands and prophetic books that go into the hundreds and even thousands of pages of text down to these two things, which is exactly what he's saying, everything hangs on these two things, then these must be the big picture. This must be what it's all about. So I think we'd be justified then tonight in taking a real careful look at what he's saying and what he's not saying here, since he's putting this really at the center. This emphasis of Christ to say these belong in the center and everything else can revolve around them is echoed elsewhere in the Bible. For example, in the book of Romans, Paul says in chapter 12, 8 to 10, "Let no debt remain outstanding except the continuing debt to love one another. For he who loves his fellow man has fulfilled the law." The commandments, like don't commit adultery, do not murder, do not steal, do not covet, and whatever other commandments there may be, are summed up in this one rule: love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no harm to its neighbor. Love, therefore, is the fulfillment of the law. So Paul agrees with the teaching of Christ. We could cite numerous other examples as well. You know, the new commandment that Christ gives. 1 Corinthians 13, the better way, that faith, hope, and love abide, but the greatest of these is love, and so on and so forth. In passage after passage, the New Testament and the Old really are adamant on this point. So, in thinking about it then, since loving God is the greatest of all commandments, what does it mean to love God? Are we doing it? Are we able to do it? Or do we sit and look at this, and as I often have, in all honesty, and just thought to myself, yeah, I don't know whether I'm doing that or not. I mean, I think I love God, but you know, I wonder what exactly, how would you know, how would you measure success in this area? Well, let's think through it. You know, we talked some a few weeks back about love in the biblical framework, didn't we, when we were discussing dating and marriage, and we brought up that the idea of biblical love, which is a different and unique concept, completely distinct from what we have in the modern conceptions of love. And that, of course, was talking about a romance relationship compared to a relationship based on servant love, a self-giving love, an agape type love. And we said, you know, there's some big differences there. Let's go back to that thinking then and bring that thinking over, because I think we're going to find that a lot of those concepts are going to come right in here as well. For example, in John 14, verse 15, Jesus makes this well-known statement, "If you love me, you will keep my commandments." So, according to this formulation, to love me, you know, if you love me, then that would automatically mean that you would do my keep my commandments. There's an action component here. It wouldn't be enough to feel warm toward God based on this, would it? When we think of, what do we think of love when we say I'm in love? In the modern world, we're thinking about an impulse of the sentiment going out of our heart, you know, and that may all be involved, but the problem is that that's pretty much the totality of what love is in the modern world, and that would not be good enough to be considered biblical love, because biblical love might start with that, might start with our heart going out. But it would have to be more than that, and would have to include action based on that, in this case, following his commandments. What about Jesus? Here's another example to think about. I'm going to throw a few different biblical reflections on this whole question of the nature of love, loving God, loving others, kind of into a hopper and toss it like a salad and see what comes out. I think this one is interesting. When Christ confronted Peter after his resurrection, and he said, when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these?" I don't know what he was pointing to. Probably to the fish and the boat, which was what Peter had gone back to when he gave up on Christ. He went back to his fishing business. And so it may be that it was his business. The world. And Christ may be saying to him, "Do you love me more than these things?" And Peter says, "Yes, Lord. You know that I love you." And Jesus says, "Tend my lambs." Then he says to him again, a second time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he said, "Yes, Lord. You know I love you." And he said, "Shepherd my sheep." And then a third time he says to him, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" Peter was grieved because he had said to him a third time, "Do you love me?" And he said to him, "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And Jesus said to him, "Tend my sheep." Well, this is really odd, isn't it? I mean, just think about that conversation for a little while. That's an odd one. Of course, Peter had just denied Christ three times. And so maybe this was part of why Christ three times came back at him with this question. I'm sure that's involved here. I think there's other things involved in their use of words that don't come out in the English here, the interplay of two different words for love that we don't have time to get into tonight. Because the point that I wanted to draw your attention to tonight is the other strange part, the way that each time Peter says this, Christ comes back and says, "Tend my sheep." Now, you know, here at one moment we're talking about a relationship. The next moment we're talking about shepherding sheep. What's the connection? There's a relationship. There has to be a relationship. And in fact, it's a very direct relationship. Christ is saying, "So you do love me? Yes. Then tend my sheep." There's an action component here. There's more than sentiment. Christ is saying, so what you're saying is you feel sentimental love toward me. And Peter's saying, "Yeah." And he says, "Tend my sheep." Put some feet now on that sentiment and do the thing that someone who loves me would do. Yeah, I would say this from the ones we've looked at so far, that it's impossible to miss the action component in biblical love in these passages. It's clearly there, and you'll find it really in all passages just about love. We've argued here earlier that in modern conceptions of love, we include the sentimental part, but we discount the commitment part, we discount the sacrificial service part of love. And therefore, we end up with a type of love, a concept of love, which is really a concept that makes me feel good. That to love another person is to get that cuddly, warm feeling. It's a desire for the other person. That's what love is. Not according to God, not according to the Bible. That desire and cuddly feeling, that may be compatible, that may be involved also. But you don't have love until you have this action component, until you have this, until you're ready to form a commitment and to do for the other person. Jesus says, greater love has no man than that he give up his life for his brothers. Self-sacrifice, that. And that has to be a part of what love is all about. So when Christ says that you have to love God with all your heart and soul and mind, remember that he's speaking of love in his terms, not modern terms. And so, no, I don't think this is a call to spiritual eroticism, where we're going to try to get this blah feeling that makes us cry out for God. We're really more talking about a knowledge of God's love, a depth of love that leads us into commitment and to the willingness to do for him what he already did for us. Christ gave himself up. The Bible says that Christ loved the church and he gave himself up for her. That's what Jesus did for us. It was more than a feeling. It was also that he went to the cross in our place. And God is saying, learn from that. Jesus often said, love one another as I have loved you. Well, I think he wants us to love God as he has loved us also. That's the nature of what really loving God is about. It's a multifaceted thing, and it includes commitment, and it includes action. Aspects of love that don't seem to weigh very much in modern definitions. We might say, well, commitment, the willingness to serve another, that could grow out of love. We don't see it as integral to love. We see it as probably something that would come along besides, not in the Bible. To God, that is the part that is love. Right there is what you do, the service that you render. Now, in the Romantic tradition, which we live under since Renaissance times, we could love someone secretly at a distance, though we have never done anything for them, right? The one of the most famous cases of this was Dante, who was in love with this woman and wrote the Divine Comedy honoring this woman with whom he was in love, though he never knew her personally or spoke with her. He saw her, he knew who she was, that's all. And so we find that that could easily be the case in a romantic conception of love, because it's a panting of the heart after someone. And whether anything beyond that happens or not is really, that, you know, that's history, that's not love. Now, and again, then, see the difference. Behold the difference between that conception of love and biblical love. In biblical love, no. You could not love someone from a distance, never do or anything or serve them in any way. That would not be considered. You might like them, you might feel compassion for them, but that would not meet the biblical definition of love. In Luke 10, 27 and following, Christ gave these same two. Well, actually, the other guy did. One of the guys in the crowd said, these are the two greatest laws, aren't they? And Jesus said, yes, they are. But then the guy wanted to justify himself because he knew he wasn't keeping them. And he says, so I have to love my neighbor as myself. Yes, but who is my neighbor? A typical legalistic ploy to kind of dodge the moral intent of the law and say, I know I don't love this guy, but of course he's not really my neighbor when you think about it either. And so Christ then told the story of the Good Samaritan. And in the Good Samaritan, you had a man beaten, near death, perhaps already dead, certainly bloody, near death, lying on a road, beaten by robbers, and men walking by, clergymen, a priest, a Levite. These were men who served God. That was their business. It was a profession to serve God in the temple. And here's an interesting point to think about with the Good Samaritan. You know, a priest who touched anything dead, or in many cases bloody, would become ritually unclean, and as a result could not perform their service in the temple. Actually, these men who walked by this bloody corpse or whatever he was had a good religious rationale for why they really probably shouldn't get involved in that type of mess over there. And so what they expressed was not contempt, was not hate, just indifference. And for all we know, those men who passed by, he says on the other side, may have looked at this man and their heart may have gone out to him. They may have wept, for all we know. They may have looked at him and said, I can't believe what our society is coming to. But they passed by on the other side. They did nothing. That's the issue. Did they love the man? They did not love the man. He needed to be picked up and bandaged, not wept over. There's a stricter definition at work here. Now, the Samaritan did go over. He did pick that man up, and he put him on his donkey. He got off the donkey and put that man on his own donkey. He bandaged his wounds, meeting his short-term needs. He took him to the inn and put him in there and gave the innkeeper money for a week. And he says, I'm coming back by here another week from now. And if he's not better, I'll give you more money. And he met his long-term needs, his short-term and his long-term needs. And Christ said, that is what I'm talking about when I say to love your neighbor as yourself. That's his example. Well, again, there you see, there is compassion. It says in the text, the Samaritan passing by felt compassion. We're not saying that that's not involved here. We all know that that's involved, the compassionate part of love. But we're saying the other part is also involved. The commitment, the servitude, the self-sacrifice, the doing. Love is something in the Bible, something that you do, not just something that you feel. Now, let's take that understanding then and think about it. Our call to love God goes way beyond simply having a cuddly feeling toward God. And here is something that struck me thinking about this, is that in so much of religion, people are wanting to cultivate a sense of loving God. And there's a vast literature that's been written on this. And often, though, when they say this, if we read their literature and really reflect on and listen carefully to what's being recommended, their definition of love is modern. And it's not biblical. And so as a result, What do they end up seeking in response to this call to love God with all your heart, soul, and mind? Spiritual eroticism. They believe that what they have to seek with God is something analogous to what you would feel if you were falling in love with a woman or a man, what have you, as the case may apply. And they're interpreting love in romantic or erotic terms, not in biblical terms. There's a lot to think about here. Well, let's look at what he says, with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. What is this heart? We know now the heart is an organ that pumps blood. But how is the word used in the biblical parlance? First, the heart is a pretty broad concept, and I'll show you. I listened to one speaker that says, okay, well, you're supposed to love God. Here was a spiritual eroticist, okay? And I listened to his tape, and he was slaying people and carrying on and stuff, and he said, well, what matters is that you love God with all your heart, soul, and mind. And he said this, when you see a series of things like heart, soul, and mind, then the first one is the one that's the most important. And the heart, therefore, is the most important. And he says, in a word, he says, without going into all the scriptures, I would basically tell you that your heart is your feelings. Well, so in other words, by this kind of tortured series of reasoning, what had he come out with? That the most important thing is to have some feeling toward God. That's what matters the most. But that's not what this passage teaches. And that's not what heart means either. Neither is the first in the series necessarily more important. Really, none of his points were true. Here is, listen to the Bible in its own words. We do find that the heart includes our intellectual powers. Esau said in his heart, I will do such and so. He reasoned in his heart, according to the text. Jesus says to the multitude, why do you reason these things in your hearts? So your heart is a place where you can reason to yourself. Sometimes it is seen as the seat of our emotions and our feelings. We have passages like that in Proverbs 27:11, where it says, be wise and make my heart glad. So your heart can feel glad, but your heart can also reason. Nehemiah the king refers to this as nothing but sorrow of the heart, he says. Your heart is sorrowful. So it could be the seat of our emotions. On the other hand, at times the heart is the seat of the will. And if anything, this is the most common use of the term, and both in the negative and positive sense. For instance, when it says in Jeremiah 17:9, the heart, people's heart, is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. This is referring to the, you know, the heart of man, that the what we are on the inside, our entire personality, personhood, is our heart, and that is very deceitful. We tell ourselves what we want to tell ourselves, and desperately wicked, because we're so desperately selfish. We're so selfish. We're so determined to avoid self-sacrifice, to get others to sacrifice for me. That's what we're all hoping. We're desperately wicked in this sense. And God is meeting that. I think a good way to conceive of what God is calling us to in this command to love God with all our heart, soul, and mind is just to look at this verse and just think of this, meeting it as an antithesis, head to head. In place of this, our deceitfulness, the truth, and in place of our desperate wickedness, our desperate determination to hold out and get the advantage for self, to do the exact antithesis of that and to throw ourselves out in total self-sacrifice unto God. The very thing we're most reluctant to do. And God, Christ is saying, that is the heart of what the law is all about. In Deuteronomy 8:14, God warns that your heart might be lifted up. And when that's an idiom, to have your heart lifted up means pride, that you become proud. So the heart is like the self, really, in many uses. In Romans 10:10, Paul says, with the heart man believes, resulting in righteousness. So when we come to this point where we have understood Christ paid the price for my sin, Christ has gone to the cross and done it all, Christ is offering me eternal life as a gift, and I have to reach out with my hands and accept this free gift without deserving it, without earning it, just as I am, before I change, not afterward. And I make the decision and say yes to God. Who says yes? My heart says that. And that decision of the will, that's my heart that responds to God's call and says, yes, God, yes, I will take your gift. And that then results in righteousness. I become a forgiven person before God. The Bible teaches that humans can resist God, who respects human will, and our heart can become darkened, our heart can become hardened against God. For instance, in Exodus 8:32, the Bible records how Pharaoh hardened his heart against God. He was going to let the people go, but he hardened his heart. And he decided not to give in to God. People do that. People will be sitting and thinking, maybe I should let God into my life. And then they harden their heart and decide, no, I'm not going to do that. Mark 8, verse 17. Jesus says, aware of their discussions, Jesus asked them, do you still not see or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Do you have eyes that you fail to see, ears that you fail to hear, and don't you remember? And so Christ, almost marveling here at the sight of something that was really sort of terrible, these people had seen a miracle, but it was not having any effect. They were resisting belief. He says, are your hearts hardened? And then he repeats a couple of things, which I take it are different ways of saying the same thing. Do you have eyes, but you fail to see? Do you have ears, but you cannot hear? That's what happens. Okay, if we harden our heart against God, if God calls to us, and we know what God's will, we know what he wants, and we say, no, and we do this repeatedly to God, we begin to harden our heart, and it has an effect on our whole person because our actual perception begins to change. Boy, do I ever worry whenever I see myself or anyone else apparently hardening their heart against God, because you can start this all of a sudden, everything they look at is skewed, they see it in a different way. Their perception's been altered by the hardness of their heart. Now, we're a lot more subjective than we like to admit. We think, yeah, well, I'm really objective. I go by the facts. The facts as we choose to perceive them. And a person with a hardened heart cannot see the truth. We read in Mark 6:52, they did not consider the miracle of the loaves, for their heart was hardened. Here was a group of people who just no longer could even consider even miraculous data. Any kind of data would have bounced off these guys by now, because their heart had a thick cake of callus, just like a finger of a heavy workman whose fingers have just become so stiff and thickened with skin that he just can't feel much with his fingers anymore. And that's the way our heart gets when we're chafing constantly against the knowledge of what we should do with God, and we're saying, no, no, no. We harden our heart. And then finally, we see in Hebrews 4:7 this call, today, if you will hear his voice, do not harden your heart like the other time. Don't harden today if you hear his voice. And that's the thing. Even if you've hardened your heart a lot, all of a sudden, you may be sitting there and you may, in a moment of time, you may hear God, because he can still be heard at certain points. And suddenly look up and just then, well, no. You're trying to tell me something, God. You're saying this to me. And he's urging us, when that happens, don't harden your heart against God. Let him in. Let him have his way. Say yes to God. Well, these are all different ways that the term heart is used. And so to love God with all of our heart is really describing a very open type of relationship. A relationship that is not self-willed, that is not holding back, that is letting ourselves go into God and his will. Then he says also, love God with all your soul, which in the Greek language is the word psyche, from which we get psychology. The psyche is the soul, the mind, the feelings. It's actually quite a number of things. It's the personality is what it is. The word comes from a term meaning the breath, to breathe, and it would be said that someone has breath in him, he has life in him, he has psyche in him, he has a soul. So our life force and our personality, we love God with who we are as a person. And of course, concept of personality, complex today, complex then too. And if we did an extensive study of psyche, we would see it used in a lot of different contexts. Then we have too that we should love the Lord your God with all your minds. And our mind, their mind, their meaning for the word mind, very similar to ours actually. I couldn't detect any difference. We know what our mind is. That's the thinking part of us, right? Part that thinks. The question is, what does it mean to love God with our minds? I've posed this question to a few people in recent days, and we often get a little catch, a little bump in the road here, as we find that this is a question that isn't easily answered by a lot of modern Christians. Not easy to answer this question. What does it mean to love God with my mind? Why is it hard for us to answer? Same reason we already discussed. Our conception of love is that love is something you do with your feelings. We don't see love as something that you would do with your mind. More with your heart, that part we can get, but not with our minds. Christ says, no, also with your mind. That's included. To love God with my mind. I have a mind. You know, so many of us here have powerful minds. I know some of you, I know quite a few of you who have impressive, powerful, dynamic minds who are really able to think at an incredible depth. We have people sitting here who are mathematicians who could make most of our heads spin. Scientists, legal minds, business thinkers, and so on it goes. We have thinkers sitting here, disciplined, well-trained, able to tackle critical problems and to think through them, powerful thinkers. And God says, you know, that mind that you have is a stewardship. I gave you that. Because God has a mind also. He's made us in his image. And he says, that is something you're supposed to love with that also. To love God with our mind. reminds me of John 4:24. It says, Christ speaking to the woman at the well, God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. And that's that second part is the part with our minds. Truth has to do, that which is true and that which is false has to do with propositions that we think about. We cannot claim that we have loved God if we have not taken the time or the effort to learn who he is or what he says. Again, we may advance a purely sentimental version of love, an erotic version of love, and say, I love God. But who is this God that I love? I don't even know if it's really the God who's there, or is it the God that of my own imagination? So often, frankly, yes, it is that. And God is saying, no, not God as you would have me be, God as I truly am, me. I'm the one, and that's why you need to use your mind, because there's a lot here to understand.
Now, I don't need to think about it. I know who God is.
No, you don't. You probably don't know what you're talking about. You're probably so full of misconceptions and falsehoods about God. You need his word to instruct your mind and to teach you who it is you're talking to, and then love that God. Some people are really just expressing so-called love for God. It's nothing more than a yearning for a God of their own making. And that's the modern and postmodern way. We make up our own God and worship him. And in that sense, we're no different than ancient man who used to just carve a god out of wood and worship it. Our man-made gods, we think they're nice. God's saying, that's not me. You got the wrong guy there. To love God with our minds, then, means that we care enough to understand him and his word, his revealed word, the scriptures, as much as we're able. Obviously, we'll never understand God fully, an infinite being of that sort. But we can understand part, and the part that we're able to understand, the part that he's revealed to us, we care enough to go out and do the work. Those of you, I know there are hundreds of you, who come out and spend your time taking classes and studying your word, and this is time well spent, because you're learning who God is and what he says. That's loving God with your mind. And Jesus says that's part of it. That's really very much at the center. This then is what it means to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and mind. It's to be willing to serve him, to be willing to commit myself, to follow him, to obey his commands, to give myself over to him with my will, with my feelings, and with my mind. It's a surrender and a lasting one. There may be a day where I don't feel like continuing on, where I don't feel like any surge of love feelings on this particular day. And we discussed that when we were talking about how biblical love as a commitment can be practiced when the feelings are there and when they're not there, both. We're not subject to that. We're not victims of shifting emotional states. Because we can make the commitment and we can live for God on the day that we feel like it and on the day that we don't. Now, along with this then, he gives us the second commandment. Jesus did not feel he could give one, because the guy just said, which one is the biggest? And instead he says, I'll give you two. Now, the other one is, the second he says, is like it, is like the first, namely, love your neighbor as yourself. This phrase, is like it, the prefix homo means same, it's extreme similarity. He's really saying this is so similar that it's almost a different way of formulating it. It's almost like saying the second is the same as the first, and some translators would translate that way, that the second is like unto the first or is the same as the first. In other words, he's saying you can look at it as serving God and loving him with all your heart, soul, and mind, or you could say to love your neighbor as yourself. And really, these have to come together. These have to come together. They cannot be separated. Unless both are there, we're not fulfilling either. This teaching, tying together, loving God and loving others, inextricably, weaving them together, is also, again, repeated over and over in the Bible. For example, how about in Matthew 25, verse 36, when Christ meets those coming into heaven and he says to the blessed ones, I needed clothes and you clothed me. That's like the Good Samaritan, right? I was sick and you looked after me. That's like the Good Samaritan. So these blessed ones, they served Christ. They loved him. They cared for him. They took care of him. I was in prison and you came to visit me. But they come back and say, well, when did we ever see you hungry and feed you? I'm having trouble remembering that one. And they also go through all of them. When were you sick and we took care of you? Can't remember that. And Christ comes back and says, the king will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did it for me. No, it wasn't that I was literally lying there and you clothed me. But that one that you did clothe, I consider that the same as if it had been me. I consider that the same. And so enter, he says, into the joy of your maker. So isn't that interesting? Here he's almost equating loving others and loving God. It's a very strong teaching. How about stating it in the inverse? Here is the inverse version of the same notion. 1 John 4, verse 20. John says, if anyone says, I love God, yet he hates his brother, he's a liar. For anyone who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And God has given us this commandment, whoever loves God must also love his brother. So there is a horizontal axis as well as a vertical axis involved in this whole way of life that the Bible characterizes as the life of Christian love. It's not enough to love God. According to all of these passages, actually, one who feels, I just have such a deep love for God, but it's not being carried out in realistic, biblical love for other people, is really mixed up, has completely missed the point somewhere along the line. And this is really not to be a dead letter. What we're discussing here is extremely real. Christ says, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you. He wants us to learn this way of self-giving love, not only for God, but for other people. And in a sense, when we do love other people, we literally draw closer to God by doing that, and it becomes a means of growth. It becomes a way in which we experience God's love in a deeper way. Well, so we've been talking about the verses themselves in the abstract. Let's draw a few conclusions. First of all, the point in this passage is not just that God calls us to love him and to love others. That's the obvious part. But the real issue, the strategic question, or the main point is not just that he calls us to do that, but that he ranks these things above all else. Right? He says this, the whole law and all the prophets hang on these two things. This is the point of the passage. Yes, we know that Christians are called to love. We know we should love God. We know we should love our neighbor. But have we considered this part? That this ought to be elevated and placed in a position of, that it, such that it dwarfs all other things. All other things. I really think this is not always happening. You know, Judaism could be considered a religion of ethics. A very ethical religion. Of course, they have other parts too, but at the center, when we speak of what is at the center, what's the biggest theme, it's an ethical thing. Islam puts zeal at the center. A religion of commitment. Zeal. And some call it fanaticism. But definitely a very zealous and committed, loyalistic faith. New Age religion is a religion of self-discovery. That's our way in the West. We're out to discover self, to be me. Some religions feature self-denial. Some Eastern mysticisms center around harmony with nature. Christianity is a religion of love. What, you know, when we speak of what's at the center of the wheel, what's at the very center, different faiths and creeds would put different things there. What Christians are supposed to put there and what Christianity does put there is this notion of love. The Bible teaches that God is a personal being, that the universe is a personal place, and that if you want to know what it's all about, where is it all headed, what's it all about, it comes down to personal relationship and this marvelous concept of self-giving love. I wish that throughout its history, the church had really featured this the way we should have. You know, because whether you look at it from a historical perspective, you could easily draw out hundreds of episodes where the church, so-called, has been the very furthest thing from anything that could be considered love. And still today, we could meet, and I have met Christians who I felt are some of the meanest people I've ever met. Just savage, angry, nasty people. And we think to ourselves, how far astray can you get? This is what's supposed to be at the center. Yes, I'm sure they're committed. I'm sure they're observant. I'm sure they're pious. But my gosh, the anger, the nastiness there. Man, are we missing the boat when that happens. For Christians, love is the bond between us and God. John 3:16 says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, so that whoever would believe on him would not perish but have everlasting life. God so loved the world, and this is the bond that we have with God. It's not a bond of duty. It's a bond of love. It's a relationship. For us, love is the motivational base for us as Christians. And 1 John 4, verse 19, John says, we love because he first loved us. The thing that makes me able and willing to hazard, to risk going against my own desire to feed the self, to affirm self, to aggrandize myself. The thing that would make me do something as crazy as to cast myself out in self-denial, self-sacrifice for others, it's because God has loved me. When we taste the true love of God, we start to make contact with something so powerful, we realize this is truly the Almighty. We're tapping into something now that's really different. And so these crazy thoughts begin to hit us, motivated by the Spirit. You know, you ought to try a life of love like this as well. Give it up. Give up your efforts to establish yourself and give yourself up for others. Well, you know, when you try to teach kids to swim, I was just remembering learning how to swim. I was not one that took to this very easily myself. And I must have been pretty young or something. But they got us out in this pool. I was not enjoying this. And they were trying to get us out to teach us how to float on water. And everything I had always done in water was to sink in water. And he started moving us out into this deeper part of the pool. Well, you know, when you're learning how to do it, you try to, like, keep one foot down or something so you could, just in case. And so you sink. And you're like, nah, I knew it. I knew it. It wasn't going to work. And it's not until you commit yourself. You've got to really arch your back. You remember that part. You've got to commit yourself. And lo and behold, boom, and you're like, whoa, wow. It works. And this is what a lot of us need to go through in our lives, is that we're still holding to the self-first premise. And we have not yet really taken the chance and committed ourselves the rest of the way to what God is telling us here, to say yes to the idea of giving ourselves up in love to God and to others. Love is what we have to share with non-Christians. People say this, why don't you leave the non-Christians alone? Let them have their way. You have your way. No. We have to share the love of God with others. This is a love too great to keep to yourself. It has to be shared. And of course, love will bring us a significant amount of blessedness and growth in our own lives. And I haven't really stressed this point. I don't want to stress this point because, you know, even though Jesus said in John 13:17 that if you love one another as I have loved you, you'll be blessed. You'll feel good because of that. And we have this teaching in several parts of the Bible. Acts 20, Jesus said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. That you actually will feel more edified and built up by giving than by receiving. But the problem is that happiness that we receive, that blessedness that we receive from loving others is not our goal. That is not what we are here for. I watched John Stossel's special on TV last night, all about happiness and how to get it. And you just realize, and he, you know, some parts of it were pretty good. They documented and demonstrated that people that win the lottery all say within a year, it brought me no happiness. Well, that's predictable from a biblical point of view. No, you cannot get happiness through money. Some of the other things they had were not as biblical. But, you know, one thing you realized is that everyone watching that show is sitting there saying, yes, I've got to have it. I want it. I need to be happy. And here's a paradox for us as Christian believers. You know, that's not why we're here, to be happy. And maybe you thought that you would come out and hear a preacher tonight who would tell you that God can make you happy. Well, that's really not my message. My message is that we are here to love God and to love others, not to be loved, but to give ourselves in love. And truthfully, yes, some substantial, significant happiness will come along. But that is not our goal. And if it were our goal, then we really wouldn't be involved in self-giving love, would we? If we went out thinking, okay, I'm going to do this and that'll make me happy, we would really be not acting in any sense in a self-sacrificial way. And do you think that people ever do that as Christians? We do that. And how would God work with us on that? How will God deal with us if we're coming out ostensibly to love God in this same way he loved us and others too, but really because we think this is going to be the best payoff for me? I'm sure that he is probably wise enough and powerful enough to smoke that truth out. And he will smoke it out. And he will show us, he will bring us to a point in my life when we are able to stand before the mirror of God's law and realize, I do serve other people, but it's really for selfish reasons. And that's why I'm thinking about quitting. It's because the payoff isn't there for self. And now we're at the point where we can make a more mature decision of whether we really want to serve. God will bring us to this point. And it's a marvelous thing when we are finally able to so come outside of ourselves and to so set the self aside that we can become truly other-centered, centered in God and centered in others, and our love for them. We'll understand then what this way of life is all about. Okay, I'm going to stop right there tonight. Why don't we turn to God in prayer? Heavenly Father, we want to know this love of yours in a deeper way. And I doubt that a single one of us can sit here tonight and say with any honesty, I'm glad I have this part down. We know, Lord, in fact, that we don't have it down. That here and there we've glimpsed it and we've experienced it for periods of time and situations, but then we fall back into our self-absorption. And so I think the more we reflect on what you call us to here, the deeper we sense is our own need. And I'm sure that's why you confronted us with this tonight, Lord, was to show us, not that we have it together, but to show us that we really need your grace and that we need your forgiveness and that we need your power to draw us out of our self-absorbed world and outlook into real love for you. Teach us what this means, God, and cause us to become deeper in our love for you. Some of us are sitting right here tonight, Lord. We don't even know you in a personal way. We have never yet invited you into our heart. And yet, tonight, we feel you speaking. We hear that you want to come in and form this relationship. I pray, Lord, that we'll reflect on that verse we read in Hebrews 4:7, that today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your heart. That we will realize, Lord, tonight, for once, I'm not going to harden my heart anymore, and I'm going to say yes to you and let you in. And I'm going to begin my relationship with you and let you forgive me. I can't offer you anything. I don't deserve it, but I'm willing to accept it as a gift. We thank you for that in Christ's name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.